Well, you got to see this fellow's face a couple of times since I messed up the song. This is an old picture of Robert P. Dugan Jr. By old, I mean really old. This is a 1971 picture. It's the only one I could find. Brother Dugan served as a pastor in several churches for a number of years. He also served as chaplain of the Colorado State Senate. In 1976, he made a run in Colorado for Congress. It was an unsuccessful run. My contact didn't come in any of those places with him. He wrote two books, one of which I did know about, and this is a book where I had the contact. He wrote this back in 91. We lost. Yeah? I personally think we have lost that war that he was talking about. He called it a civil war. It really was a war for the culture, which, from my perspective, that war, don't stop fighting, but it's more like guerrilla warfare now. I'm fearful. But in this particular book, he cites a story. Let me tell you a little more about him, too. After he lost the election, he became a member of the National Evangelical Association. And because of his political background in Colorado, he became the lead liaison for the National Evangelical Christian Association in Washington, D.C. And he served there from 78 until 1997. Now, he has since gone home to be with the Lord, but this is a man who kind of looked at things from a political viewpoint. That's what he worked for. He worked for what he believed were Christian values, to promote Christian values and legislation that promoted Christian values on behalf of the NEA while he was there. But when he was on the campaign trail, he often referred to a long quote that he listed and put in this book, and I'm going to read about two pages of the quote from winning the new Civil War, because I think they're really relevant today. And I wish every young person had to read the book he's about to quote out of. I've lost mine and I need to get a new one. Every high school sophomore ought to read it and should have to read it again as a senior in high school. It's a book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. "We Americans do not adequately appreciate the political process in our nation," Brother Dugan writes. During the campaign, he's talking about his campaign for Congress. "During the campaign, I often recounted a nightmarish 1938 incident from Alexander Solzhenitsyn's," and that's for those who are not aware of who Solzhenitsyn is, a tremendous intellectual man. He's made some very dire predictions about our country after just being overwhelmed by the wonder of it and its freedom. But he has a book, The Gulag. Is it archipelago? Archipelago? What it means is Greece has them. An extension of islands that are a series of islands, and these come off the southern part of Greece. The reason for that title, The Gulag, you all understand what that is. This book is a collection of testimonies, of real life stories from people that Solzhenitsyn met while in the Gulag himself. And he put them together in this wonderful book. And for these young socialists that we have running around this country wanting to pick up the banner of socialism, would you please pick up Solzhenitsyn and read him? Would you please do that for yourself? But he goes on to write, and there is the book that he's quoting from. "By way of contrast, a distinct party conference was underway in Moscow province. It was presided by a new secretary of the district party committee, replacing one recently arrested. At the conclusion of the conference, a tribute to Comrade Stalin," that's Stalin, Joseph Stalin. Somebody wants to tell you about all the murders in the province, and the church did. There's a lot of ugly part of the church history with the Catholics. People killed, inquisitions. It doesn't even begin to touch the number of human beings killed by Stalin and Mao Tse-tung. Over 3 million plus put to death by government, by socialistic government. 3.1 million that we know of. So this standing of this ovation was called, applause or calls for Stalin was called for. Of course, everyone stood up, just as everyone had leaped to his feet during the conference with every mention of his name. The hall was storming with applause, rising to an ovation for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. The stormy applause rising to an ovation continued. But palms were getting sore, and raised arms were already aching, and the older people, that's me, were panting from exhaustion. It was becoming insufferably silly, even to those who adored Stalin. However, who would dare to be the first to stop? The secretary of the district party could have done it. He was standing on the platform, and it was he who had just called for the ovation, but he was a newcomer. He had taken the place of a man who had been arrested. He was afraid. After all, NKVD men, the NKVD were the People's Commissariat for Internal Affairs. After all, NKVD men were standing in the hall applauding and watching to see who would quit first. And in the obscure, small hall, unknown to the leader, and he's talking about Stalin. Stalin has no idea this is going on. The applause went on. 6, 7, 8 minutes. Think about that. You're standing up and you have not stopped for 8 solid minutes. Their goose was cooked. They could not stop till they all collapsed with heart attacks. At the rear of the hall, which was crowded, they could, of course, cheat a bit, clap less frequently, less vigorously, not so eagerly, and not be readily noticed. But with the presidium, it's a word I didn't even know what it meant. Presidium was a committee of leaders within the Communist Party. That's what the presidium was called. But with the presidium, where everyone could see them, they were up on the stage. The director of the local paper factory, a paper guy, an independent and strong-minded man, stood with the presidium, aware of all the falsity and the impossibility of the situation. Still he kept on applauding. 9 minutes. 10. In anguish, he watched the secretary of the district party committee, but the latter dared not stop. Insanity. To the last man, with counterfeit human enthusiasm on their faces, looking at each other with faint hope, the district leaders were just going to go on and on, applauding till they fell where they stood, till they were carried out of the hall in stretchers. And even then, those who were left would not falter. Then, after 11 minutes, the director of the paper factory assumed a businesslike expression and sat down in his seat. And a miracle took place. Where had the universal, inhabited, undescribable enthusiasm gone? To a man, everyone else stopped dead and sat down. They had been saved. The squirrel had been smart enough to jump off his revolving wheel. That, however, was how they discovered who the independent people were. And that was how they went about eliminating them. That same night, the factory director was arrested. They easily pasted 10 years on him, on the pretext of something quite different. But after he had signed Form 206, the final document of the interrogation, his interrogator reminded him, "Don't ever be the first to stop applauding." Now, this story is being told to you for a reason, because it demonstrates the tremendous power of what I call group peer Cohesion. You probably won't find that in a dictionary, so let me explain what I mean when I talk about group peer cohesion. It is the use of group-based influences, group-based pressures to cause a change of behavior in a fully conscious person who is a mentally normal individual. The only way you can account for, I don't know how many people are in that room in the hallway, but the only way you can account for reasonable, intelligent, normal people stand up and applauding and cheering for 11 minutes for somebody who wasn't even there is by group peer cohesion. That is the only way. And this is something that the church must make every effort to guard against. We cannot allow group peer cohesion of any form inside the body of Christ. Instead, and this is particularly true in the area that we're looking at, in the area of giving, instead, we need to be people like David, an individual, a man who stood most of his life on the principles and the truth of the Word of God. I've looked at David for one reason. We got to Revelation and chapter 3 at verse 19, and we found that believers were told to be zealous and repent. And I've been trying, okay, what did you mean to be zealous? And we got all the way down. And I did this, this should be simple. I'm just going to take the emotional human enthusiasm, I'm going to put it on one side of the piece of paper, then I'm going to take on the other side of the piece of paper and list all of the differences between the two, because there are sharp contrasts. In David's example, I was able to see two of them and be able to demonstrate. Here's two of the contrasts, two things that are very different. What is related by Solzhenitsyn concerning that particular meeting, that is an example of emotional human enthusiasm. That's not an example of genuine zeal for Joseph Stalin. Had it been, it had never stopped. You'd have had to carry him out dead. They would have kept on. So we're looking at this, and I call this zeal, that's the real deal. The kind of zeal that God would have you and I to have for Him, the kind that Jesus is commanding in Revelation 3:19. And one of the differences that we see in David, and we'll see more, that human enthusiasm does not glorify God, but it promotes the zealot. Do you really think the enthusiasm in that auditorium that night was really promoting Stalin? They were promoting how zealous they were in their particular case for protection. Now, I'm sure most of them understood the need for protection. Where biblical zeal, it doesn't glorify the zealot. It always honors. It always glorifies the Lord God. And secondly, human enthusiasm. The minute one guy had the bravery to stop clapping, everybody stopped. It wanes. It dissipates. But biblical zeal does not. And I found this especially easy to see in David. And this is where you could see it. First of all, it's quite clear that his zeal for the Lord did not diminish, because you can see him involved, his active involvement in wanting to build the temple for God. And even when God said, no, you can't build it. You can't build it. David's desire did not diminish at all, which is made manifest, one, from his giving. He gave, as we've seen, a lot of money in things that are valuable for the building of the temple. But that is it, then I won't get there for another week or so. But that's not the main way I see his zeal. That's one of the two. But the zeal of David continued to burn in his heart. It did not stop. His giving, providing funding, manifested the reality of that zeal, as does something else. That provision of funding, I saw five things from that. I said four last week, but I really had five. I saw five things from that. I said, well, this is interesting. Here I'm looking at an Old Testament believer who lived under the law, and you have all these people today trying to tell you, and you have many trying to tell you you're supposed to live under the law. No, you don't. We don't live under the law. Jesus took, the law was taken to the cross and nailed to it. Finished. Done. We live under grace. But one of the things that so many who want to drag you back under the law to live under say, well, if you have to tithe, you have to tithe. Here is a man who lived under the law. His funding had nothing to do with tithing at all. In fact, his funding is what I call a gold standard for giving from the Old Testament. If you want to understand giving from the Old Testament, don't look at the law. The law had nothing to do with about a person's giving. It had to do with the person's taxation for dealing with the monarch which the people of Israel are going to be living under, under the rule of God, to support it. And in David's gold standard of giving, I call it a five-carat giving. It real gold in David's giving. And I could see five out of the seven. These seven I've known for a long time from the New Testament. I really had not attached these to the Old Testament until I did this. As I watched David's giving and the things I could see, there's five clear-cut characteristics concerning giving. The New Testament lays out, and I call them conscientious or conspicuous, I used to call them conscientious, conspicuous features that are characteristics, or at least supposed to be characteristic, of our giving. So when somebody wants to talk to you from the Old Testament about giving, you take them back to David and say, here you go. This is giving. This is what you should see in giving. And the things that we see, and I call this, I stuck the picture. I try and put things in a mental picture that will help me keep them in mind. Just like, it's a strange way, but the way I see the Bible verses, I see them on the position on the page. Pat was asking me about one, just couldn't find this morning. He said, well, what start the passage for me? I probably know it. Oh, okay, that's Philippians. It's somewhere on probably the lower part of my page between 314 and 320. And so things like that help me see them. And so when I think about that, I see, and here's what I see as being characteristics. These are to be conspicuous characteristics, not conspicuous, when I use that, not conspicuous of me to any of you, or you to any of me. Conspicuous to God, in God only, as we shall see. One, believers are commanded. We covered that. 1 Corinthians 16:1 through 2, 2 Corinthians 8:11. We have direct commands to participate in giving. And then the C start with, and we covered this last week, cheerful. 2 Corinthians 9:7. I probably could add one. I don't know if it's. I'm not sure if I'm going to reverse them. Deuteronomy 16:17 or 17:16. I think is where you see the same thing in the Old Testament. We added to cheerful last week. It is to be a conscious choice. A choice. I don't think those people were standing there applauding by choice. They were standing there applauding because of group peer pressure on them. Conscious choice to willingly give. 2 Corinthians 8:10, 12, and 2 Corinthians 9:7. And we also covered carefully considered and concerted. Really, planned is the better word, but concerted was the only synonym that I could find that worked with plan that was worked, started with the C. So, and we went to that. Our giving is to be planned in advance, long before we give. And to me, it's something believers, I think, ought to sit down at the beginning of every year. Or something changes in circumstances. You have to, plans are subject to change, always, always. But a plan, I have a plan to give already. And it is never, 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 and I mean never, ever, to be coerced. Ever. You ever feel coerced to give? Don't give. Don't give. Because it's not going to bring honor and glory to Christ. It's not going to be to your presence or to your spiritual benefit. Coercion is not to be a part of giving, and that puts a tremendous responsibility on me, any other pastor, radio evangelist, teachers, TV evangelist, missionaries, it doesn't matter, Christian groups, Awanas, what are some of the Christian groups you can quickly think of? Navigators, InterVarsity Christian, Campus Crusade, any of those groups. Not to put, and I'm not saying those groups do, right? These were just groups that I know. But any group seeking or person seeking to receive money from believers, not in any way. We have a sacred responsibility. We have a sacred responsibility unto the Lord that we do not in any manner cause a believer to feel coerced. Here in 2 Corinthians 9:7, the primary passage. We've got the first part. Every man, according to as he has purpose in his heart. That's where we see the planned, giving, right there. So let him give. Now here's the phrase that says it can't be coerced giving. Not grudgingly or of necessity. And then we explain why it's not to be that way. We covered that last Sunday. For God loveth a cheerful giver. Take just a few minutes. I want to look at the words. Different translators do it differently. Not grudgingly or of necessity. I think that's how my King James Version does it. I think the New American Standard does something like not reluctantly or under compulsion. And that compulsion gets across, I think, really well, better probably than necessity. Or NIV or others, not grudgingly or under compulsion. Okay? That's when you look at not of necessity. So I think of necessity different. I think of necessity as things that I need. Now that's the first thing my mind associates with it. I don't associate immediately compulsion. But that's the thought. Now, there's something that probably should be noted. Not grudgingly or of necessity, or whether it says reluctantly or under compulsion, it doesn't matter. Both of those are part of a prepositional phrase. In front of not grudgingly and in front of not reluctantly is a little Greek preposition ek, which is expressing that the source of our giving is not to flow out of what I call reluctant resentfulness. That cannot be the source. It cannot be out of reluctant resentfulness. And I know believers who gave to the Catholic Church because I was, a lot of my family, you're Italian, you're Catholic by default. That's just the way it was. Okay, I had left when my mom and dad got divorced. I moved removed from the Catholic Church by age 7, but all the rest of my dad's family for a long time remained Catholic. And about the year before Pat and I got married, but most of the year before that, I lived with just a man who helped turn my life completely around as a man. Just my Uncle Hank was a wonderful man, as was his wife, my Aunt Marie. Just loved them to death, and they took me and loved me as their own. My Aunt Marie was a Catholic. My Uncle Hank was a drug and along, and he would go. But until he finally got really hacked with them, he wouldn't go at all. But when he gave, it was out of reluctant resentfulness. He didn't want to do that. But he felt compelled. He felt pressured. Probably as much by my dear aunt as maybe by the church. Don't do that. That's not to be the source. Wrong source. And churches have, and I'll show you some way they do that today, some great ways of bringing group peer pressure that results in money coming out of reluctant resentfulness. They don't care. They're putting the pressure on for that specific reason to give. Those who don't want to give, force them, pressure them to give. In the context, the reluctant resentfulness is related, and it's directly related to giving out of necessity or giving out of compulsion. The reason I am reluctant and resentful about my giving is because this word, anege is the word translated necessity. It is the word translated compulsion. Now, this is just a direct quote from the lexicon you see, Art and Dean, a Greek English lexicon of the New Testament, of the early Christian literature. Now, you see these last words real big. I'm giving them the emphasis. Charlton Gingrich did not do that. They just say, quote, necessity or constraint as inherent in the nature of things. And there are ways to make the nature of giving, and the church has done this for years, there are ways to make it become inherently pressure. And I use the words, in big words, pressure of any kind. You feel any kind of pressure whatsoever, you don't give. We're not to give in that manner. Here's another lexicon, because I'm not going to go looking at passages with this word. To force, constraint, necessity, compulsion. We are not to give on that basis. It's exactly why you don't see a plate pass in this church. I've never allowed one in this fellowship. Ever. Why? And Patty proved my point to me. I always felt this. Could never prove it. But when a plate goes down an aisle, you tell me people don't feel some, not be strong. But if the guy next to you throws in a $5 bill, go buy me, I'm going to put in nothing. Well, some people will do it. And the reason I know it applies pressure, Patty was a treasurer, I don't know, for a lot of years at her previous church. I mean, a long time. And her church used giving envelopes. I will at least thank you that you did that, and there's a reason for that, which I'll deal with later. But Patty told me every Sunday they would open envelopes and find nothing in the envelope. Well, why did a person put in an empty envelope? You're costing the church money. You're wasting an envelope, dude. These aren't free. Why would you do that? Because you felt compulsion. You felt a pressure. Maybe not a big one, but you felt a pressure to give. You can't do that. There's not any way that you are supposed to put any sort of pressure on anybody to give in the church. There are three reasons why I don't use the plate. Here's number two. Number three, I'll wait till we get to that point. Number two is now here it's not been the case, sadly, and I am sad about that. We don't get many visitors. But when a visitor comes in, I don't know if the visitor's a believer or an unbeliever. I can't. Believers don't light up. Believer. And big B's don't come out of our hearts, or big U's don't come out of unbelievers' hearts. So I have no way of knowing. But what I do know is an unbeliever is not to participate in giving. And what concerns me with that is not so much he's not to participate in the giving, is that I'm fearful, concerned, that unbeliever sees, okay, other people giving, these Christian people give, and they're okay with God, so I'll give like they give, and I'm going to be okay with God too. He is going to think, or she, that I'm doing what they're doing, so that makes me as good as they are. You may be better than they are, I can't tell you that, but you're not as well off as they are. But they think so. And so we don't pass a plate. We don't pass a plate because we're not supposed to put pressure on people of any kind. It's my job to see it doesn't happen. My responsibility here. And if you ever feel compulsion, don't give. This guy, he's got a great book. His name is David Lee. I love the title of his book. There it is. Sunday Morning Stick Up. Great sense of humor. Okay. That's what he calls the book. Now, I read portions of what he had. CNN, which is not, again, I read New York Times. I wish I could get a copy of the Times article that they had yesterday for one of the guys I work with. Great article about what's happened to Kavanaugh in the New York Times. But this came from CNN News, which is obviously, most of us know, this is not what you would call a middle of the road or a conservative leaning paper. You know, and they were doing an expose. And this is what hurts, because all of us get hurt with this. All of us believers. They were doing an expose on what Christian giving. And they were citing some things from David's book. And here's one of the stories that David tells, that's in his book. Now, since not reading as David, but CNN giving us the story, here's what you see. David Lee had just opened his wallet for two successive offerings at church on Sunday morning. And you just stop right there. Two offerings. We're supposed to prepare our gift for our giving in advance. How many people do you think were prepared to give two successive offerings that Sunday? Probably not none. I'd be stupefied. When a pastor walked on the pulpit to pass on a request, a request to the people. And here he comes. Y'all got to think I'm crazy. But God says, give again, said the pastor. I want you to hear the words. God says. Let me ask you, if you believed, as so many in so many circles teach, that God is actually speaking, the man is speaking, that's God speaking to them, and it's not coming from the Word, if I'm sitting in there and I really believe that God says, give again, what am I going to do? Am I going to, well, the heck with you, God, I'm born to give it twice, I'm not giving anymore. I don't care what I have to do. If I believed that statement to be true, and I believed in my heart that I was supposed to do, give again, I would do it. Now you tell me that's not putting pressure on people. Well, it doesn't stop there, okay? So, no, but this is, they didn't do this when I went to regular churches. This is something new to me, and I live a pretty isolated life as far as what happens in churches. I thank you. I don't want to go to any. The congregation rose from their seats to march to the front. They don't pass the basket in some of these churches anymore. They don't pass an offering plate. People get up, they go forward, and then they put their money in plates that are stacked along what they call the altar, what I call the stage. Now, again, you're sitting there, and other people are getting up, and they're going up to give money. Everybody in your row gets up, and you still want to just be left sitting there? I don't think most people have the strength, the emotional strength, or crass enough to sit there. I think most people cave into the pressure. I really do. I think most people are going to get up and go forward. And so why do you think the pastors are doing this? Because they want more people to give. They're doing just the opposite of what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to make giving completely no pressure situation. Let's go with the story as the organist plays a soothing melody. Here you are. You're in this situation. I call it this. If you're sitting there in the seats, give or be embarrassed, okay? It's give or be shamed. That's what they've done to you. And that is group coheres pressure. No part. Just no part of our giving. Oh, the story doesn't stop. As they dropped off their offerings, the pastor urged them on. As they said, God said give three. That wasn't enough. The pastor urged them on with, God says, give everything. Don't hold anything back. Okay, I'm going to ask you, if you're a person who believes that's actually what God said, what do you want to do? You're going to give everything. You're going to give everything. And I'm going to show you some of the things that were given in this offering that David saw about people giving everything. The organist then picked up the tempo. And the pastor tells the people, God says run! God says run. The offering ended with people surging toward the altar like music fans rushing a concert stage. It was pandemonium. Does apostle at all things be done decently and orderly? Doesn't he warn the believers at Corinth about potential chaos in their own church because that's not the way the church is supposed to operate? And why does not want the church to seem chaotic? Because an unbeliever might come in and see you. What the number one reason written for unbelievers not wanting to go to church, they're just sick and tired of hearing about church talking about money, needing money, pleading for money, begging for money. That's all they hear half the time. Money, 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 money. They're sick. What would you think of that as an unbeliever? As a believer, it makes me sick. I can't imagine what an unbeliever sitting in that situation, I would look for, where's the back door? How about, or the front? I'd have got up with them all right and gone right up the exit. Just awful. Well, it's not done. Not done. He goes on with this story. They weren't just giving money, but shoes. God said give everything. Giving shoes, watches, diamond rings. Lee says there were people dropping alligator shoes on the altar. Now, again, I'm going to go back to a basic thing we learned last week. I wonder if that man or woman had, how much planning and giving, okay, on this Sunday, I will give my alligator shoes. Had planned in advance to do that? Well, of course not. Of course not. And yet, this kind of pressure placed upon people results in this kind of giving. Here, keep going. One lady took off her wedding ring and dropped it on the altar. And again, I would ask, what woman actually sit at home and said, well, you know, this Sunday, after the first offering, and the second offering, and the third offering, then I'm going to get my wedding ring. Now, he called it, what did he say? I didn't get it on the tape. He called it, that's how charged the atmosphere was. People got caught up. No, they didn't. People, the atmosphere was group, peer, cohesion. Whether they understood what was happening to them or not, they were being coerced. The person who gave his or hers, and I don't even say which kind they were, man or woman's, whoever gave the alligator shoes, whoever gave the ring, that person felt coerced to give because God said give all. They were just trying to do what they thought God said. That pastor should be so ashamed of himself before the Lord for what he did to those people. The pressure he put them under. Just awful abomination. Awful. Here's another one. This is hard because I listened to him, and I think my grandmother drugged me to one of his tent meetings when I was living with him in Oklahoma. This was one of my grandmother's. My whole family, very poor family. They were dirt farmers, or migrant workers. Didn't have money. But my grandmother, years before, was all wrapped up in the Pentecostalism. Long, long ago. And this was one of her favorite preachers. I got to hear him on the radio a lot when I was a young kid. And I'm not sure whether it was his tent meeting or somebody else's. It was a huge tent, that I know. An enormous tent. Earl Roberts. I'm sure most of you know who he is, right? He was one of the biggest TV evangelists, probably the first big TV evangelist from the Pentecostal movement that there was. One of these faith healer guys. Here's a sad story. Kenneth Hagin is considered to be the granddaddy of the modern day faith movement. He and Oral Roberts together. I don't say this with any sort of delight at all. I just say it to prove the point of that false, awful doctrine about faith and faith healing. Oral Roberts had a child born. The child became very seriously ill. Kenneth Hagin and Oral came in, laid hands on the child, which that's the right thing to do, even though I don't really understand. That's what we're told to do, and they prayed, and they prayed, and they prayed. They prayed what they would call the prayer of faith. These two men, prayer of faith men, the child died. The child died. Why? Because the doctrine's a false doctrine. It's a false doctrine. I had a horrible incident this week of what false doctrine does to people you love. But on to Oral. Okay? If you're an ardent Oral Roberts supporter, if you were a lover, and I don't understand how, but if you were a lover of the Oral Roberts ministry, and you heard Oral Roberts, they put out a letter first, then he puts it out on TV. I've got quotes out of the letter. And he gets on TV and says to you, if I don't raise $8 million by March of next year, I'm going to die. If you heard that and you believed it, let me tell you this. Now, Chester would never stand up and say anything like that. Period. But if I knew that I loved him dearly, my dear friend, best Bible teacher I ever heard, if I'd heard him stand up and say in 1974 or 5, and that's what I was really just getting under his ministry, beginning to learn, if I'd heard somebody buzz around the church, you know, Chester's got whatever, and he needs this operation, but insurance will only cover this much, and if he doesn't have the operation, he's going to die, I would have done everything in my power. I'd have given everything I had that I could give. I would have done everything I could do to raise as much money as possible for him to get the operation, because I loved him. I loved his teaching. Well, I'll just flip that coin over, and that's how you feel about Oral Roberts. And there are people I know who felt that same way about him. And he says, $8 million by March, or I'm going to die. Feel any pressure to send some money in? You get a letter. This is what he put in the letter, as well as put it on TV. I desperately need you to come into agreement with me concerning my life being extended beyond March. States a fundraising letter signed by Oral Roberts. Next, click. God said, I want you to use ORU, Oral Roberts University Medical School, which, by the way, was not needed in Oklahoma. He built a 777-bed hospital. And was told that Tulsa did not need a hospital. Tulsa could not support the hospital. Tulsa did not have much illness with the hospitals they had. It wouldn't survive. And it didn't. It would bankrupt millions of dollars that people got hurt. But God said, I want you to use ORU Medical School to put my medical presence on the earth. As if it wasn't. I want you to get this going in 1 year, or I'll call you home. That's what he told people. If I don't get that $8 million, and I will give him this, he at least it said his intentions were to use that money for scholarships to bring men from foreign countries, Africa basically, specifically, and to give them scholarships to go through medical school. That's supposedly what this $8 million is supposed to be used for. I'll call you home. I'm going to be dead. Well, I don't want you to be dead. You're my teacher. And then he goes on, and this really frustrated me, he goes on to link himself to the Apostle Paul. And he goes on to say, he doesn't write the passage, but this is the passage. I'll tell you what he says in a minute. But he's referring to this passage. One of my favorite verses on top is the one I placed on my brother's gravestone, headstone. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I live in the flesh, that is in this body, this is the fruit of my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I know not. For I'm in a strait. I'm between a rock and a hard place. Having the desire to depart and to be with Christ, you betcha, because which is not just better, which is far better. Better than anything we can imagine. You can't even put it into words. Nevertheless, to abide in the flesh, that is my body, is more needful for you. So this is what Roberts comes off of. He pulls off the latter part of this. Well, I really want to go home to be with the Lord, you know, but it's better for me to stay here so that I can continue to minister to you. So this is what he writes. When it looked like Paul would go on to heaven, his partners flooded him with the necessary money, each one giving to God's servant out of their own need. Well, Paul's, you know, people who, you know, he calls them partners, because that's what he called his people. They were his partners. Paul's partners forked up the money so that Paul wouldn't have to go home to be the Lord. He could stay here. By the way, It worked. He got $9.1 million. And you're talking 1970... when did he do this? 70s or 80s? Maybe it's in the 80s. I've forgotten. It's been a while. But that was the 70s. At any rate, $9.1 million. Because he put pressure. That would be intense pressure, as far as I'm concerned, to get somebody to give. It's awful. And I don't care what kind of pressure is used. I consider the passing of plate a subtle form of pressure. I consider what that pastor at Oral Roberts said, that's heavy-handed pressure. Neither pressure, from the slightest to the heaviest or any thumb level in between, is acceptable by God. And if you feel even the slightest of pressure, do not give. It's contrary to God's word. Never coerced. My next C. Now, one more out of here. For every man, according as he has purposed in his heart, so let him give, not reluctantly, out of pressure. For God loveth a cheerful giver. Next. The amount one gives is to correspond with the capacity one has to give. Not hard to understand. Pretty simple, I think. This has nothing to do with somebody getting 10%. It has to do with what one has to give. That's what he ought to give. There ought to be a relationship between what I have and what I give. And I can do it cheerfully. That can never be removed from the equation. Never do you take cheerful out of that. But what one gives is to correspond to one's capacity. Here, 1 Corinthians 16:2 is one of two places. 2 Corinthians 8:12 the other, and I'll see it later, not this morning. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, and here's your key phrase, as God hath prospered him. We're going to look at this. Lay in store as God hath prospered him. And why do that? That there be no collections. It's exactly what the word logia means. No collections. No collections in the church. Paul didn't want any. You plan in advance and you set aside what you can cheerfully. And when I'm here, then it will be taken to saints in Jerusalem. A couple of observations I'm going to make from here. The words each of you, every one of you, those words indicate that every believer, that's what I think the neat thing about God's program, every believer can participate in giving. Every believer can participate. There really isn't an exception to that statement. Every believer can participate. And the degree that we can participate obviously is going to be relative to the capacity that we have to give. If our capacity is very, very tiny, yay. You put in a copper coin, you participated. You participate. And God gives us all that opportunity. This verb, lay, put, set aside. That's the three translations of Tithemi from the four translations that I read. It literally does mean to set. But observe that this is a present tense verbal, so this denotes an ongoing action. Or I put it this way, this is something we are to do regularly. This is something we are to do repeatedly. It's not just one time. It's just to be an ongoing activity on the part of the believer. And then again he says, upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay in store as he hath prospered him. If your text says God, that word's added, it's probably the correct word. The verb just simply does not have a subject. Subject's on the end. And the verb just says, he hath prospered you. And I take the he to be referring to God. But there's some parts of this that I want to point out. Ouch, this thing hurts. A couple of things. Right here, each one of you lay by, I left out the word him, lay by him should be in there, lay by him. Now, that indicates this is something, what I believe that is trying to say is that each week you take something and you put it someplace in your own personal possession, your home, wherever you're living, because the church, we didn't have a highly organized church today, not even organized as we are, we don't have much organization. A church didn't have a church treasurer. Okay? Church didn't have a church bank account. It didn't exist. So you're not taking the money to the church. He says, what I want you to do is each week you find some place that you can put it yourself and then put it there. In a simple term, every week put it in a savings jar. Okay? You have a savings jar. Put it in the jar so that when I come, then it will be there. So that's up to you where you're going to put it. Now, here's the word I'd like you to note that is not, it's badly mistranslated. Only one translator deals with the word kind of properly and then messes it up by what he puts in. The words as hath, as he may prosper. This word as, in both of these cases, is a translation of three Greek words. Hos, ti, eon. The word hos, ti, eon, that particular phrase, used three times in the New Testament. Right here, Matthew 6:23, Colossians 3:17. Now watch what this phrase, it means literally, whatever. It doesn't mean as, it means whatever. And here are the passages. Herod Antipas, sworn to her, Salome, the daughter of Herod's wife, Herodias, whatever. They don't say as. They translate has, ti, ehan, whatever. That's what it means. Whatever thou shalt ask of me, I will give thee unto half of my kingdom. Here's the only other place the phrase is used. And they should leave it correctly in the passage we're in. Colossians 3:17, and whatever. Has, ti, ehan. It's not as, it's whatever. Whatever you do, in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord, giving thanks, of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks. Here's the translation, literally. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store whatever. Now you've got to fill in the blank. Now what the New Revised Standard Version did, I think it's a horrible fill on the blank. They filled in whatever you have left over. Okay. I guess you could fill that in with that. But it seems to me, in light of what we've already seen and what he just said in the context, here's what I put on my blank. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by in store whatever you choose to save with gracious cheerfulness. That's what goes on that line. You have to, whatever you can choose to give with gracious cheerfulness, that's what you put there. That's what you're to put away every week. And that's how I have translated. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store whatever you choose to save with gracious cheerfulness. Now notice, now there is, you have this little codicil that goes along with it, this little addendum. As he hath prospered. Okay, so I am to, whatever I choose to save with gracious cheerfulness, but that's to correspond with how I have prospered. And how I have prospered is a good translation. You get, there's three different translations of this words, hath prospered. Uadotai. The reason you have three different translations is, unfortunately, the Greek, the form of this particular verb can be, and some translators have translated it as a perfect passive subjunctive, can be that form. Some translators have translated it as a present passive subjunctive, and it can be that form. And some have translated it as a perfect passive indicative, and it can be that form. But the end readout, it doesn't matter. The end readout of this is not going to matter which form that you put this in. The perfect tense, as you know, if that's what you're going to do with it, this is a past action that has abiding results. So it would be, as Okay, at the end of the week, I know how much I've been prospered. Okay, that's what I have. Based upon what I have that week, and they were paid daily at that time, so it was a week. At the end of that week, this is what I prospered. This is what I can cheerfully put away. I put it away. If you want to do it on a present passive, subjunctive, same thing. Whatever I've been prospered, whatever that might be that week, I continually put that away every week. It doesn't change the meaning. And if you want to make it a perfect passive indicative, the indicative simply means you are to do this. Well, I know I'm to do books I'm commanded earlier. So the readout really doesn't make any difference. I take it and have translated as a present passive subjunctive. And my voice is about to go. So I translate it this way. May be prospering. As you may be prospering. The reason I think the present passive subjunctive is probably the best is because the way you and I may be prospering changes. Or at least in my life it has. Okay? It's changed over the course of the 53 years Patricia and I have been married. But what the word teaches that there is to be a direct proportion, we give with direct proportion to the way we're prospering. Now, I said, you know, it's changed a lot. When we were first married, you know, Pat was making a buck, still on working, I was still in school, still in college. Pat was making $1.75 an hour working as a stripper. And she was a good one too, and I told you that, very good stripper. I've watched her strip a lot. Did it for me. She's fast. And that's what made it so good at it. It wasn't taking off clothes. It was working on opaque negatives. So you get all those spots out of them so they don't show up as blemishes on your face. Okay? So $1.75 an hour. That was our income. And I had to go back and look at that time. Social Security was $3.85. Okay, that came out of it. Federal tax, we were paying 16% out of our check at that time. I do not know what Kansas withholding tax was. I've forgotten. But I do know what we took home was less than $38 a week. So right around $38 a week. That's what we take home. Prospering was just a little. In fact, so little, I went to the grocery store. Remember that, Pat? Remember the potato? Okay. For those who do not know what that is, okay, that's before we had calculators. And I wanted to be sure I was right. That's a little hand clicker in ads. She would put something in. I pushed the basket. Anyway, I wasn't, you know, I didn't work two jobs and I wasn't, you know, pastoring. So we got to do a lot of things together. We went to the grocery store, went to a place called Save-On every Saturday together. I pushed a cart, she threw stuff in. And I looked at it. If the thing said 97 cents, I clicked it to a dollar. Okay? Everything I had, I rounded up to the next number. And when that little counter said $10, boom, shopping was done. It was over. That's all we had to spend. $38. That's all we had to spend for shopping. Now, I wasn't going to a church at that time, any church. But if I had been going to a church and our rent was $60 a month, because I had a hemorrhage for about 2-3 months before I decided to buy a house, that would cost us $65 a month if we bought it. To see, could we make the money stretch? It was tight. It was tight. If I'd been going to church and you have to give, you know, cheerfully, mine would have looked like that. Okay? There'd have been copper things going in. That's all I could have done cheerfully. We just barely had enough, you know, get from Monday to the next week. That was it. Now, thankfully, by God's grace, we're prospering. We no longer have to live on a minimum wage salary, okay? We're prospering better than that. And because we prosper better than that, I can cheerfully put more than copper coins into the plate or into giving the church. There is a relationship between what we are blessed with and what we give. But in that, and I never take it out. Never. What can I do cheerfully? Cheerfully. And if somebody's prospering a lot and all you can cheerfully put in is copper coins, okay. Okay. I would tell you that's all to put in. That's all to put in, if that's all you can do cheerfully. But I would also remind people that something that God does say is truthful. But this I say, he who soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he who soweth bountifully shall reap bountifully. Now I want you to look at a couple of this word bountifully. That's the word I want you to see, because there's something worth seeing inside that word. The Greek literally reads upon blessing, not bountiful, but upon blessing. All of these passages I have listed, and there's a number of them, I'm going to just look at one of them. There's a number of passages where every time you see the word ulagia, and that's the word translated bountifully, that it means blessing. Here's just one of them. In fact, three times this passage uses the noun, the adjective, and the verb. Ulagia, the whole word family, notice every time, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who hath blessed us with all spiritual blessings, in with all spiritual blessings, and there it is again, in the heavenlies, in Christ. The word denotes blessing. Blessing. There's something else to note about it, because again, I watched some of these hucksters take passages like these and then ream and twist them to say, well, the more you give, the more money you give, the more money you're going to get. That's not what is promised. That's not what it says. It says that Loanida will tell you this is an idiom, and it is. And it translates it a large amount of something, with the implication of, and this is where I put the stress, blessing, benefit. So he defines it a large amount, abundant amount, abundance. He uses, in fact, this passage. So one who plants in abundance will reap in abundance. Now, let me give you this translation. The one who plants in blessing, with a view to blessing, will reap blessing. Now, that's because that's what the word means. Now, what do you do with that? Why are you going down this route? I'm going to finish this. I'm going to get done at this point. But this he say. But this I say. He who soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly. He who soweth blessing. This whole context that we find this giving talked about in 2 Corinthians 8, 9. It was a collection for who? Believers in Judea who were suffering poverty, who are really having a very difficult time. What those people were doing and giving, they were sowing what would be a blessing to other believers in Judea. And then you shall reap a blessing. You shall reap blessing. Or, you know, get more money. Here's the most common way the word is used. And so here's the blessing I would tell you you could look forward to. If we're giving with all other things being equal, right, the most common meaning of the word ulagia in the New Testament is blessing. And when the word is not being used in the context talking about saying good things, that's just basic meaning, to say good things. Anytime you don't see that word talking about good things, the blessing the word denotes is spiritual blessings. So what is one going to deny himself? But let's say I have the capacity to give, instead of a handful of pennies, I have the capacity to give dollars. Several dollars. And if I can only cheerfully give the pennies, well, only cheerfully give the pennies, wrong. But what you're going to be missing out, because you have the capacity, you're going to be missing out on some spiritual blessings. Not spiritual blessings, I think, that are present in time, space, history, but also spiritual blessings that will be on your account for all eternity that will enable you to better equip Christ. So we need to think, again, that's why you sit down and plan. Okay, this is what my income level is at present time. I got bills and obligations. But I can give this cheerfully. And when I'm giving, it does correspond. It's not what I have left over. I don't believe it should. I hate that with grace. People think, well, you're giving grace, you give the leftovers. That's grace. Yeah. No. Do you consider Jesus a leftover? Not me. God sent heaven's best when he sent his son. In grace. And in grace, we ought to give the very best we can give. And again, it's what we can do. I'll never forget this brother I knew better. And see, there's been a number of years ago, some friends of ours came in from out of town. Okay? I had just bought a new truck right before they came in town. They came in by air. One local could use, because he knew I had four vehicles. Can I borrow one of your vehicles? Sure. And I gave him my brand new truck. Well, why would you give me the new truck? And he said, because you asked me to give you something, and grace, we don't give second best. This is the best I had to give to you. That's the way we ought to give, even in grace. Here's the conclusion. The Lord's will is that believers give in a manner that is consistent with their capacity. That is God's will for you. That is God's will for me when it comes to the matter of giving. And never am I to put pressure on you. Never are you to be under pressure. You just need to know what the principles are concerning New Testament giving. And those are for you and God together to sit down and you pray, work about what you want to do. Because if we give in a manner that's consistent with the principles of New Testament giving, those C's, then we're giving a sacrifice. A sacrifice. That's what God calls it. It's a sacrifice that's acceptable and is well-pleasing to God. Any questions? Let's pray. Father, we thank you again this morning for the living word. We thank you, Heavenly